From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as the TV season concludes, we look ahead to the new season and consider some of the changes in the TV landscape. We'll talk with our TV critic, David Bianculli. Then we'll talk with our critic-at-large, John Powers, about some of the new movies he saw at the Cannes Film Festival in France, which concluded over the weekend. Last year, Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 won the top prize. We'll hear about some of this year's winners. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is the big week for season finales on TV. Meanwhile, the networks and sponsors are looking ahead to the new season. So are the TV critics, including our own David Bianculli, who is also the TV critic for the New York Daily News. We're going to talk about changes at the TV networks and new programs getting ready to premiere. David just attended something called the Upfronts, at which the networks unveil their fall schedules to advertisers. Later in the show, our critic-at-large John Powers will tell us about some of the movies he saw at the Cannes Film Festival, which ended over the weekend. Well, David, while our critic-at-large John Powers was in France at the Cannes Film Festival watching all the exciting new movies that will probably be heading our way soon, you were at an industry conference in New York seeing and doing what?
I was running through the Dog and Pony Show, where all of the networks unveil their season schedules for the fall. And there are some critics that are invited there, and there are some reporters, but mostly it's to the advertising buyers who are going to throw billions of dollars towards these six networks, and they're all competing, like, buy my show, buy my network, don't buy theirs. It's not quite being on the beach in France.
So what do they do? What do the networks do to try to convince the sponsors at this conference to buy spots on their shows?
Well, the first thing they do is they try to pick programming that's going to appeal not only to the viewers but to the advertisers, because it is an advertising medium. The second thing they try to do is to put the best face possible on whatever horrible things happened to them the previous year.
And
to say, you know, I mean, it's sort of like NBC for years has ruled the 18 to 34 demographic, for example, and made this a huge deal. This is the only group we're interested in, 18 to 34. Well, this past season, they went from first in the 18 to 34 grouping to fourth, which is like a major tumble. You have to pass lots of networks. You know, the only things beneath them now are UPN and WB, which hardly count as networks. So what they're now saying is, we're number one with the upscale 18 to 34 households that spend more than $100,000. So they just try to make it as good as they can. But of course, another thing they do is the rival networks make fun of everybody else. And so they point out these things. So by the time the advertisers have gone to all six upfronts, they pretty much know who's weak and who's strong based on last year, and then they make up their own minds based on these little 1 minute, 90-second cutdowns of the pilots that have been chosen for the new season as to what they're excited about.
Do the advertisers want to invest as much money in network programs as they used to, given the amount of competition with cable, the internet, TiVo? A lot of people are TiVoing their shows, mm-hmm. and not even bothering to watch the ads anymore.
No, it's a great question. There is sort of like, if you have enough money to invest and you're supposed to diversify your portfolio, there is more diversification where advertising groups or individual advertisers will target cable. You know, you can reach a lot of young moviegoers, for example, which is a huge market. So all of Hollywood wants to buy for the young 18 to 34s who are deciding on Thursdays what to do the next night. And for that, even though you can advertise on Comedy Central, you can advertise on MTV, the biggest buy is still the mass medium of television. So they still do want to go there. But right now, Thursday night, for example, accounts for 40% of all the advertising revenues in primetime, which is why the Thursday night, which used to be owned by NBC and now is totally up for grabs, is so fought over.
So are the networks moving in their big shows to Thursday nights now?
Yeah, more and more. I mean, CBS started it a few seasons ago by bringing Survivor in, and then that worked. And then Fox brought in The OC, which went for the really young demographic. And with Joey underperforming once Friends left and The Apprentice being a little weaker this year, for this fall, it's going to be a six-way battle, including UPN, which had its first, I think, real serious cult hit last year with Veronica Mars, is putting on what, based on little cutdowns, is, I think, one of the two best new shows of the year.
Did you see anything in the cutdowns that allows you to actually speculate what the new season might be like or what individual programs might be like?
It's really tricky. It's like pre-first impressions when you see these cutdowns. I mean, one of the things that you can tell when you're at the upfronts, because these things are held at various New York venues, one's at Carnegie Hall, you know, one's at Radio City Music Hall. So you have, you know, 1,000 people there. And if they show a new program clip and afterward it's as though they've attended a funeral, you get a really good sense that this is going to be a hard sell and probably a bad show. But you don't really you can't tell with a lot of the creative shows from 90 seconds whether it's good. For example, at last year's upfront, they showed the entire pilot, NBC did, of Joey, because this was so important because of Thursday, because of friends leaving. And the pilot for Joey actually was a good pilot. But the remaining 21 episodes the rest of the year just were dreadful. So that was fooled in one way. But it wasn't until about a week after the upfronts, like next week, this week, I will be getting the tapes, the full pilots from all six networks. And when you sit down and you start going through those, that's when last year Lost and Desperate Housewives popped out. You know, there wasn't a lot of buzz after the upfronts, but about a week or two later when critics began seeing them and started writing about them in advance, and then when the Television Critics Press Tour happened in July, that's when, you know, these are the new shows to watch. But yes, there are a couple that you can tell early look interesting.
What would those couple be?
NBC has one called My Name is Earl, which stars Jason Lee, who was, you know, the rock star in Almost Famous, and he's been a really interesting actor with some good choices for years. This is the first time he's done TV. And to me, it plays like a Coen Brothers comedy made for television. It's that offbeat just in even the little 2 minutes we saw. And then the other one, just as CBS loses Everybody Loves Raymond, UPN picks up a show called Everybody Hates Chris, which is Chris Rock's childhood, where he was bused to an otherwise all-white school. And so it's the Wonder Years, a half a generation later, the childhood of Chris Rock, who narrates.
That sounds great.
It is great. And the cutdown had a better response and more laughter than anything else shown. So the question is, number one, is the pilot going to be as good? Probably yes. And then are future episodes are going to be as good? And that we don't know.
Did Chris Rock write the series?
He co-wrote the pilot. I don't know. The question is exactly what you're asking. How
is
much
it a
involvement?
Chris Rock franchise,
yeah,
or is it
how
much?
Yes. How much involvement will he have? And we won't know that until he gets into it. But it could be that he'll be so excited by this form that he'll want to keep it true to himself. I don't know.
So what's the general shape of next season's TV season?
It's fairly encouraging because what happened this year, Desperate Housewives came out of the box so strong and Lost came out of the box so strong that those two ABC shows basically single-handedly reversed the course of network television. And to that I say hallelujah, because reality shows, which were getting more and more dominant, sort of faltered last year. And scripted programs written by writers, performed by actors, the old-fashioned stuff, did so well that now the networks, who are so greedy and short-sighted and stupid and always want to chase whatever is successful, are all chasing that. Now, the lesson they never seem to learn is that the reason Desperate Housewives worked is because there was nothing like it on TV. The reason Lost worked is because there was nothing like it on TV. So putting more Losts and Desperate Housewives on next year, those won't be hits. We need something that's not on now, something that's not working now. And that's why both, you know, My Name is Earl and Everybody Hates Chris have a shot. But it is a great thing. The most amazing statistic for me is that 2 years ago, there were 5 or 6 reality shows on the fall schedule. Last year, there were 21. And this coming fall, it's back to 14. That is a huge victory. And there are more comedies on than there were the year before and more dramas. Just a small number, but still, you know, I thought that was a horrible slide that we weren't going to be able to correct.
My guest is our TV critic, David Bianculli. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is our TV critic, David Bianculli. As current programs present their season finales and the networks prepare for the new season, we're talking about how the TV landscape is changing. What are some of the other big stories about this past season regarding, you know, the shape of television now?
One, it didn't occur in primetime. It's occurring in the news with all the big stalwarts in terms of the evening news. Tom Brokaw retires. Don Hewitt leaves 60 Minutes running that helm. Dan Rather steps away after the controversy. Peter Jennings is very ill right now. Ted Koppel at Nightline is about to go. You know, that's not just a sea change. That's a tsunami. These are guys that have been around for 30 years and have had those jobs for that long, 20, 30 years, and presto, nobody knows what's going to happen next. CBS is trying to change it and maybe bring some more entertainment into the mix of the evening news. But on all three networks, viewership is down by a couple million from a few years ago. And the trend is definitely that younger people are not watching the evening news as much. So, but it's still a big mass medium that attracts more than, you know, anybody else. Even the worst rated network news gets millions more than Fox News or CNN.
Dan Rather was very controversial on the right, mm-hmm. even before the
Memogate.
The Memogate thing, right. Do you get the impression that anybody in network news now is afraid of being controversial, afraid that they will be accused of being liberal, of being elite, of being, you know, any of the things that news people are being accused of right now?
I think so. I think that there's a timidity out there. There's an eagerness to please, and what I think is probably the most dangerous inclination of all. There's an eagerness to give viewers what they want. And so everything is being shaped. More and more of the newscasts are being shaped as news you want to know rather than things you ought to know. Or maybe you're, you know, Nightline, you know, it'll do 2 and 3 days on the Congo. And that's not showing up in primetime. And why not? And the newscasts, I think, to try and attract the younger viewers, may repel some of the viewers they have, not attract the young viewers anyway, and just hasten their own slide into inconsequentiality.
The 60 Minutes Wednesday edition mm-hmm. Was canceled.
Right.
The network says because it's low ratings, some media critics are speculating, is it really because of the Dan Rather controversy and the story, the Memogate story that was broken on 60 Minutes? What's the inside story? Do you know?
Well, on this one, I do believe the raw numbers really were bad for that edition. And while I don't see a conspiracy, I do see a real nice side benefit because I don't see a lot of love lost between Leslie Moonves, who runs CBS, and Dan Rather. And Dan Rather had it in his contract that when he stepped away as anchor of the CBS Evening News, that he could be a regular correspondent on 60 Minutes Wednesday. It was specific to that program. When that program is no longer there, it doesn't automatically shift over to 60 Minutes. And we asked him in a press briefing last week how involved Rather was going to be in 60 Minutes and whether he was going to be assigned as managing editor. And Leslie said he doubted very much that Dan Rather would be assigned as managing editor of 60 Minutes. Now, most of the people in this position, when you get that high up in a network, they don't say anything at all unless they have to. So the fact that he volunteered a negative, I think, is a real good indication that there is a lot of bad blood or at least memory there at CBS.
FX, which is a Fox cable network, seems to be doing really well now with really a few really dynamic programs. You've got The Shield, which is a cop show, mm-hmm. and Glenn Close is a regular in the series now. You've got Dennis Leary in a show called Rescue Me, which is a drama with elements of comedy, mm-hmm. and he plays a post-September 11th fireman with family issues and all kinds of issues. And then there's a new Steve Bochco show that's going to be starting on FX that has to do with the Iraq War. How did FX become such a force?
They stole HBO's playbook. What HBO did while programming almost no other nights in terms of original programming, targeted Sunday night, and, you know, it rolled out The Sopranos, it had Sex and the City. Whenever one show ended, another show was there, and so viewers began to think of Sunday night as an HBO place to go. What FX did was it started Tuesday, and it started with The Shield and got a lot of attention because of how raw that character was and how violent and how loose cannony it was for basic cable. The following year, they came back with Nip Tuck, the show about surgeons that very well received, just as edgy. And then the following year, Rescue Me. So 3 years, three shows, all on Tuesday. And so when one ends, another one comes in. And so they've only really programmed 3 hours so far. But they're three for three. They're all in a place where you know where they are. And there is a synergy that builds. And so Bochco's program is going to join that. I think FX has been brilliant.
Let's look at Comedy Central for a second.
Okay.
The Daily Show with Jon Stewart has really become a cultural phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like so many people watch it, and it's actually very influential now, I think it's fair to say. I don't think it's determining elections or anything, but
It is shaping the very young viewers of the networks do not know how to reach, for news in particular. It is not only reaching them, but it's teaching them. I think it's a brilliant show, and not just about politics. It does media deconstruction, which the networks just don't do.
And The Daily Show's foremost fake news correspondent, Stephen Colbert, is getting his own show.
Yes.
Starting
later, I think in the fall. Mm-hmm. September, I believe. I'm not exactly sure, but I seem to think it's a September launch. And that's going to basically just make Comedy Central an hour long in terms of the Daily Show block. It's a perfect idea. He's going to be sort of like a comic Bill O'Reilly, if that's not a redundancy.
And meanwhile, Dave Chappelle has been missing in action.
Yes.
And his show is on hiatus.
And his new DVD, which just comes out for the second season, is probably going to be the most popular DVD release of a TV show ever. Because as astounding as that sounds, his first season was. This caught everybody by surprise and is what made David Chappelle sign a $50 million contract for Comedy Central. They realized there are more people buying his show than I think there were watching his show. And that's an incredible phenomenon. The whole DVD idea has changed TV in the last few years. Family Guy is back on Fox. They're registering the aftermarket and giving it a factor in terms of what shows are canceled or renewed. And this is, you know, Dave Chappelle is a big force. And his show really is not only funny but edgy in a way that less and less of TV is these days.
David, as we've been sitting here talking about television, all I can really think about is the fact that when you started as a TV critic, there were basically three networks and a few UHF stations, and that was the menu of programs you had to write about. And with the proliferation of cable stations and more broadcast channels, how are you possibly expected to actually keep track of what's on television and keep watching series as they continue? It's not possible.
It is not. This is how stupid I am. When I started off in college to try to plan to be a critic, and I actually had at the local newspaper there a movie column and a TV column running at the same time, and I actually could choose whether I wanted to be a movie critic or a TV critic. I chose television because I figured you had 50 years less history to have to know about, so it would be easier. I didn't think that you would have, 8,000 channels and all these new technologies, and you would have to worry about, current events, and every time there's a war or any big thing, that's also TV. I mean, Roger Ebert doesn't get called up at 3 in the morning because they've just invaded somebody. And, it's just a weird thing. It is a completely different medium than it was when I started, because I've been doing this 30 years now, and I don't like to say very often. But the core of it is still the same. I still love the medium when it's good, and even though it's lost a lot of its audience, it still reaches more than any other mass medium. And at times of genuine crisis, it is still the first thing that brings everybody together. It's a fascinating tool, even if it's more misused than ever and more misused than not.
Well, David, really good to talk with you. Thanks.
Oh, thanks a lot. This is fun. This is easier than actually writing stuff.
David Bianculli is our TV critic and TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants both to promote international understanding and address the root causes of global poverty. Online at Hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Cannes Film Festival concluded over the weekend. Our critic at large, John Powers, was there. Coming up, we talk about the films and the scene at Cannes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 58th Cannes Film Festival wrapped up over the weekend. Cannes is an international festival in France that screens about 900 films and attracts over 200,000 people. Our critic at large, John Powers, was one of the people making his way through the crowds in search of good films. John is also the film critic for Vogue. After the festival ended, he went to a studio in Paris so that we could talk about some of the films he saw at Cannes that he thinks we should watch out for. John, why don't we start with the film that won the top prize, The Palme d'Or. Tell us about the film.
Well, it's a very naturalistic, behavioral-oriented film. It's called The Child, and what it's about is a young punk whose girlfriend has had a baby, and this young punk is completely amoral, and in order to make a little bit of money, he sells their baby. And it basically follows his story and his girlfriend's story and essentially learning how this overgrown child learns to accept responsibility and become a man. It sounds awful, but it's extremely well made. It's made by these brothers from Belgium called the Dardenne, who made a film called La Promesse a few years ago and another one called Rosetta, which actually won Cannes a few years ago. And they are perhaps the best realistic or naturalistic filmmakers in the world. You know, they're very good at setting out people's lives and then embedding some sort of social idea in it without being didactic or overbearing.
Now, the second big prize, the grand prize, was won by a film that Jim Jarmusch made, and that stars Bill Murray. What's the film about?
Oh, it's actually got a great premise, is that Bill Murray is a retired dot-com rich guy who is a Don Juan. And at the beginning of the film, his girlfriend, played by Julie Delpy, is leaving him. And he gets a letter from one of his old girlfriends saying that 20 years ago, he had actually had a child that she'd never told him about. The problem was that 20 years ago, he'd had so many girlfriends, he doesn't know who that woman is. So he sets off on a road trip to find who's the mother of his child and who the child is. And he then meets up with, along the way, Sharon Stone and her Lolita-like daughter, and Frances Conroy from 6 Feet Under, and Jessica Lange, and Tilda Swinton. So it's a road trip with Bill Murray doing a sort of version of the thing we've seen him do before in The Life Aquatic and Lost in Translation and even Rushmore. The kind of minimalist acting style one doesn't associate with Bill Murray. This is one of the best ways he's ever done it. It's kind of remarkable when you see him essentially work the same role over and over again, how many interesting new ways he finds to make his character come alive.
And I understand Jim Jarmusch actually wrote the role for Bill Murray, is that right?
I think the film is almost inconceivable without Bill Murray. I mean, partly because Jarmusch has always been something of a minimalist. And one of the strange things about Murray is that he's learned to act so his effects keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller, which I think fits perfectly the deadpan style of Jarmusch. In this film, there's a moment where he eats a carrot from a plate, and the look on his face, which is incredibly tiny, brought the house down. I must say that it's kind of weird to see Bill Murray become the great minimalist actor. And, you know, even watching this film, which I enjoyed a lot, I think it's a very slight film, but a really enjoyable film. But watching it, I kept thinking, you know, maybe it's time for him to stop playing middle-aged guys and make Meatballs 2 or Stripes 2. Because whenever you see him talk, he's so unbelievably funny that I kind of regret the fact that he's now sort of working this middle-aged man minimalist thing so much.
Now, Tommy Lee Jones made a film that did very well. He directed it. He stars in it. And he got the Best Actor Award. The film got Best Screenplay Award. What's the film?
Well, it's a film of a kind that often would win an award because it's a high-minded idea. What it's about is essentially it's about a border guard on the border with Texas and Mexico who kills a Mexican cowboy who's in the country illegally. Tommy Lee Jones plays this Mexican's best friend, and what he does is he takes this border guard and forces him to take the body with him back to Mexico. The movie is called The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, and it's basically about the different times this body is buried. And the whole story is essentially the story of two things. Tommy Lee Jones is essentially the last cowboy, the noble guy who gets along with the Mexicans, and he's teaching the young guy, played by Barry Pepper, who killed the illegal immigrant, that, in fact, he's a human being, too. And, in fact, essentially what happens is the nasty border guard is forced to take the opposite journey of a Mexican immigrant. So he has to cross the river back into Mexico and go across. So he's reversing the journey and, in the process, learning what it's like to be one of those people. It's a slightly overblown movie. If you've seen many movies set in Mexico, for example, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia by Sam Peckinpah, you'll recognize lots of the stuff. But what's interesting is that I think it played to a streak in the jury that was obviously in love with high-minded social themes, that almost all the movies that did very well had that, except for the Jarmusch film, which was kind of a lighthearted film. All the films were extremely earnest in their way and were actually advancing some sort of social idea.
Well, last year, the big winner at Cannes was Fahrenheit 9/11, Michael Moore's movie about President Bush and the war in Iraq, very critical of the Bush administration, as everybody remembers. So was there anything as overtly political as that film this year that got a lot of notice?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that ever since September 11th, almost every Cannes Film Festival is in some way or another a referendum on the United States. You know, last year, the vote that the Cannes community made was that Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 was a true depiction of how evil George Bush and the war in Iraq was. This year, there was nothing quite so overt, although the Danish troublemaker Lars von Trier brought out his sequel to the film Dogville, And in this, Ron Howard's daughter plays the character that was once played by Nicole Kidman. She stumbles across a slave plantation in 1930s America and essentially tries to liberate it. And the entire film becomes, in a sense, an allegory for the American invasion of Iraq. When he made Dogville a couple of years ago, it was so anti-American that Americans were outraged. By now, people are kind of used to him doing it. So people came out of this, which is also very insulting about America, saying, oh, that Lars, you know, isn't it funny how he just keeps trying to make us angry? I mean, that some of the political anger had died down. Ironically, my favorite moment at Cannes was almost the exact opposite of Fahrenheit 9/11. There was a film by an Iraqi French filmmaker who was born in Iraq called Kilometer Zero. And it had the moment that left the audience in Cannes perhaps the most startled of any moment, because it's a film about being in Iraq during the Saddam Hussein years. And the film ends with the hero having escaped from Iraq with his wife. And the final scene shows them on the day that the Saddam Hussein statue falls. They're in Paris. They open their windows in Paris and shriek out the window, "We're free! We're free! We've been freed!" And the shot shows how they're shrieking they're free and that Paris is this stony city that doesn't care at all that they've been freed. And in fact, if you are an Iraqi Kurd, I have no doubt that Saddam falling made you feel as if you'd been freed. For the left-leaning, high-minded European audience, it's hard to imagine something more politically incorrect at a film festival than ending by saying, "Saddam fell, we've been freed, and you in Europe didn't care." And the silence was absolutely deafening. And when you read some of the reviews the next day, you know, they just dismissed the film out of hand. It was the exact opposite. It was as if George Bush had somehow come on screen and tried to win the Palme d'Or. So, and it was just glorious.
What'd you think of the movie?
The movie's just okay. I mean, it actually has a few nice things in it. It's a story very much like the Tommy Lee Jones film, which is about taking a body back to be buried. This is about a Kurdish soldier who drives across Iraq to bury another soldier who has been killed during the war with Iran. And what's interesting about this is that you get, I guess, images of the Iraqi countryside that I've never seen, how barren it is and how beautiful it is. And almost no matter where you go, the one thing you always find is there's a big truck taking another statue of Saddam to another city to be erected. And that was the vision of Iraq, you know, so that the Kurds are being bombed and killed. The Saddam statues are everywhere. And that's kind of ordinary stuff. But the ending is just sublime because it really does say something that I think most people in Europe don't want to hear, which is that for lots of people, Saddam Hussein being out of Iraq was an unambiguously good thing.
Well, while we're on the subject of politics at movies at the Cannes Film Festival, one of the movies was about the French involvement in Algeria. And this won the Best Director Award. Yeah.
Well, it's actually a very indirect version of that story. A lot of the films at the festival this year were about the intrusion of the past. I mean, even in the Bill Murray comedy, it's the story about how you haven't thought about something for 20 years and you suddenly realize you have a son. In the film that actually won the Best Director Award, it's called Hidden. It's by an Austrian filmmaker named Michael Haneke. And essentially the story is about this self-satisfied Bobo couple in Paris. You know, he has a successful TV show, she's in publishing, and suddenly they begin getting videotapes of someone who's obviously watching their life. And they're completely unnerved. And as the story progresses, you realize that all of this has to do with something that happened many, many years ago when the hero, played by Daniel Auteuil, was involved with a young Algerian boy. And the whole film is a very subtle thriller about how the things you think you've buried or repressed in your past actually come back to get you. So on the one hand, it's just a personal story of somebody you treated wrong at one point coming back. But the film makes an explicit point of linking that both with the French experience in Algeria, but also with what's going on in the Middle East right now. You know, so that it's a sly political film rather than an overt one. But everyone who watched it knows that what it's really about is the way that the comfortable, settled, middle-class life in Europe, not just France, is actually based partly on forgetting all the things they've done in the past, trying to pretend that they didn't actually do them, and suggesting that no matter how much you try to pretend that you did something 30 or 40 years ago, it will come back eventually and haunt you.
John, I don't know if Ken was exactly buzzing about Star Wars, but, you know, Star Wars has opened in the States, and one of the issues surrounding Star Wars is whether this is the, I think a lot of like the right-wing media has been talking about this, is George Lucas making an anti-Bush statement in Star Wars by putting sentences in the mouths of his characters like, if you're not with me, you're my enemy?
Yeah, I'm sure George Lucas was making an anti-Bush statement by doing that. You know, I mean, I'm always amused when, you know, multi-billionaires get political in their science fiction fantasy films. You know, in Europe, they noticed it, but they didn't really care, because really throughout the world, what people like about Star Wars is the cool story and the history of all this stuff. So in France, where you would expect people to have picked up on it, you know, that really wasn't it. People on the streets of Cannes, you saw people lined up for hours just to watch George Lucas walk up the red carpet. And the French government and the French film world, which spends all of its time complaining that people like George Lucas are ruining the movies, you know, brought in the Queen Mary and gave him a special award for his contributions to cinema, which is really hilarious, because when you talk to those people 2 days later, they'll be saying, oh, no, Star Wars has ruined the world. But nevertheless, for the sake of Cannes and the publicity, they'll give him an honor.
My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We'll talk more about the Cannes Film Festival after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to our critic at large, John Powers. We're talking about the Cannes Film Festival, which just ended over the weekend, and John is joining us from the BBC in Paris. John, one of the movies at Cannes had a Christian theme to it. This is a movie called The King, which stars William Hurt. What's the story behind this movie?
Well, it's actually an interesting film. Gael Garcia Bernal, who people might remember from the Motorcycle Diaries, plays, of all things, a guy named Elvis, who's sort of an ex-sailor who goes to visit his father, who's denied him for lots and lots of years. The father is the head of a Christian church in Corpus Christi, Texas. And basically what it's about is about this kind of serpent-like outsider, played by Gael Garcia Bernal, coming into this Christian community and the effect he has on it. And what I liked about the film, and there are things wrong with it, was that it was one of the rare American films that actually took the faith of the people seriously in this religious community, and neither made the people better or worse than they actually are. It wasn't an idealization, but on the other hand, it wasn't suggesting, look at all these sad boobs who believe this stuff. I mean, it wasn't at all a red state, blue state division movie. It was an interesting movie trying to work through what it would mean for people to deal with the presence of evil when they have a Christian faith that can and can't protect them.
Well, a film I really want to hear about, Adam Egoyan, who made The Sweet Hereafter and Exotica, has a new film that played at the Cannes Film Festival, and it's based on a novel by Rupert Holmes about a Hollywood pair of performers modeled after Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. Do I have that right? That sounds so improbable.
Yeah, it does. No, I think what's interesting is that it's a slightly disappointing film with the greatest premise in the world, which is that somebody is trying to write the story of a murder that took place in 40 years ago or 50 years ago during the reign of this great showbiz team that's obviously modeled on Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. And so you actually get the great old showbiz stuff. You get the battles between Martin and Lewis. The one difference is that when Egoyan made it, he softened the Martin-Lewis parallels. I don't even think for legal reasons. I think he just didn't want to get into it. So you have Colin Firth as the Dean Martin character, playing him as a sort of English suave guy, and then you have Kevin Bacon as the Jerry Lewis kind of more cross between Jerry Lewis and, say, Lenny Bruce type. And they were this great comedy team, and a beautiful young woman is found dead in a bucket of ice in their hotel room. And the story is all about tracing back over the years what happened on that fateful night when the girl died. It was in some ways caught between being a trashy, exciting movie about Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis and an art movie. And it kind of fell in between, and people were a bit disappointed with it.
Well, another movie I really want to hear about, David Cronenberg, has a new movie called A History of Violence. And he hasn't been doing a whole lot lately, to my knowledge.
Yeah, I think this is probably David Cronenberg's best movie since Dead Ringers. He hasn't fallen on hard times, but I think he lost his way somehow. He'd started off making this pulpy, great stuff. And then he seemed to discover...
With an oddly spiritual component to it. Like he'd make movies about a mysterious sexually transmitted diseases that had an incredible spiritual component.
And his early movies were kind of messy but incredibly juicy in a good way, filled with ideas. At some point around the time of Dead Ringers, which I still think may be his greatest film, around that time he began becoming more artistically interested, and over the next few years he began making things like adaptations of William Burroughs. And somehow I think he lost some of the vitality that he once had. This new film is really his best film in a long, long time. And once again, it's a kind of classic American story that can be read as an American allegory. You know, Viggo Mortensen plays a guy who owns a cafe in a kind of small town America town. You know, such a quintessentially small town America town that you'd expect to see it in a David Lynch movie rather than in small town America itself, where they actually have Walmarts. This is a small town without Walmarts. It's a small town where everybody knows the cafe owner and so forth. One day, these gangsters come into town and try to damage the cafe. Viggo Mortensen heroically stops the crime, and everyone loves him. But there's one problem, which is the story gets so much publicity, he's then visited by a gangster played by Ed Harris, who says, "You're not who you claim to be. You were, in fact, this other guy, Joey, back from Philadelphia, and you used to be a gangster." And so then what happens is you then learn the truth about whether or not he was a gangster, and about the past of Viggo Mortensen. And his family has to adjust to the fact that maybe this guy they thought was just this ordinary cafe-owning good guy is actually something more complicated. More important, everyone has to adjust to the fact that lying inside this man is an enormous capacity for violence, and that the violence will protect you. So that, in fact, as you're watching him do violent stuff, as an audience, you're thinking, boy, these are really good action scenes. It's kind of cool. But you're also thinking, you know, what would you do if gangsters came after your family? Would you kill them? And the movie raises the question, okay, yes, you would kill them, but what does it say about you if you're actually good at killing them? And so then the whole thing in a weird way becomes a question of the American past, which with our American past is largely based on the violent taking over of our country. You know, that in fact we didn't simply come over on boats, but in fact we did cleanse the country of Native Americans, for instance. There's a deep amount of violence in our history. A lot of the violence that America has done has been justified, but the film is about how do you make peace with and accept the fact that you're simultaneously can be a tremendously good citizen, but also you're capable of enormous violence. So it actually becomes a kind of pulp meditation on that, and it's really terrific.
My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We'll talk more about the Cannes Film Festival after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We're talking about the films he saw at the Cannes Film Festival in France, which concluded over the weekend.
Woody Allen seems to make like a film a year, and his latest film was screened at Cannes. How does it measure up? Most people have been pretty disappointed these past few years with Woody Allen's movies.
Yes, well, actually, Terry, I'm going to say to you a sentence that I never thought I would say again as long as I lived, which is Woody Allen has made a really good film. It's a film called Match Point, and it's very unlike anything he's done for the last few years. For starters, it's set in London, and it's a tale of social climbing and murder. And it actually has good jokes and good drama and a narrative drive that's been missing from a lot of his work. You know, one of my friends had said that for the last 15 years, he felt that what you were seeing were Woody Allen writing first drafts and then filming them. But this film actually feels as though he actually thought it all the way through, so it actually has a good, solid energy. It's about a tennis player, a professional club pro, played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, who gradually worms his way into a family and gets involved with a young American named Scarlett Johansson, at the same time as he's wooing the daughter of a very rich British family. And from that, all sorts of unpleasant consequences ensue. But it is all the things that one wants in a Woody Allen movie that you haven't been getting. It's actually sharp, it's well-paced, the camera moves. And what's really surprising, if you've watched a lot of his last movies, is that for years he's never let anybody act. You know, he's been so busy stuffing the screen with, you know, 10 or 12 big names in every movie that everyone's on screen, it seems like, for 5 minutes, and they never have a chance to do anything. Here, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and Scarlett Johansson are really terrific, and the story builds up this cumulative power that I don't think he's probably had in a movie, really, to my mind, probably since Manhattan. I mean, it's been a long, long time since he's managed to find a story that carries all the way through and crests properly and is both fun and intelligent and moving.
I noticed that the Best Actress Award at Cannes went to an Israeli actress in an Israeli film. And it seems like more and more Israeli movies have been coming to the States. Is the Israeli movie industry becoming more significant?
It is. For years, everyone, you know, would say when an Israeli film would show at a festival, oh, yeah, yeah, we have to see this movie, you know, that they just can't make movies. But recently that's changed. I mean, this film at Cannes is by Amos Gitai, who has actually had some films that have played prominently in international festivals. And this film, which is not a completely successful film, has a seductive premise, which is Natalie Portman plays a young American living in Israel who's just broken up with her boyfriend, who talks her taxi driver into taking her along on the trip that the taxi driver is taking. And the taxi driver's trip is to an area between Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan called the Free Zone, which is an open space where people, it's essentially a duty-free area where you can buy all sorts of stuff. So they leave Israel and drive through Jordan to the area called the Free Zone, which is a wonderful idea and a wonderful metaphor. The problem is, along the way, the story doesn't make any sense, and the characters aren't given enough to do, so they're mainly just driving. So it's an interesting travelogue. The woman who plays the taxi driver did win the Best Actress Award and has a really pungent presence. And no one had ever heard of her, you know, when the film screened. And everybody's saying, who's that really interesting woman? And so everybody raced back to look at their press kit to find out who she was. And it turns out she's a comedian who's most famous in Israel for being the host of their version of The Weakest Link.
That's funny.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
Yeah. What impact do you think the Cannes Film Festival is going to have on what we see in theaters in the U.S. in the next year?
I think the impact that Cannes has in general, but in coming up in the next year, is that it becomes a launching pad for certain movies. You know, that with Cannes, they will come to our theaters in a different way than if they haven't been at Cannes and haven't done well. An interesting example of that would be the Jim Jarmusch film with Bill Murray. It finished second, and I think if it had finished first, its release date might have been pushed back and would have gotten a much bigger push, because it wouldn't just be a Jim Jarmusch, Bill Murray movie with Sharon Stone and all the rest. It would actually be the Cannes Film Festival winner. By finishing second, it'll probably open when it was originally scheduled to open. There will be other films, you know, from less famous film cultures that simply won't open in the U.S. because they didn't win an award. I mean, Cannes is, because of its prestige, because there are an insane number of journalists who go, because it's on TV every night, even in the U.S., it has a cachet that therefore helps films. And then if you go there and nothing happens for your film just disappears, and it may get released, but its life is much smaller.
Well, John, thanks a lot for talking with us about the Cannes Film Festival.
It's my pleasure.
John Powers is our critic at large and film critic for Vogue magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, surgeon and medical historian Ira Rutko on medicine as it was practiced during the Civil War, before doctors understood how germs spread disease, when surgery was mired in filth and muck. Also, director Greg Araki talks about his new film Mysterious Skin, based on a novel by Scott Heim, who will also be with us. Join us for the next Fresh Air.